Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 193 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. This week's episode is brought to you by Blue Apron.
I don't know about you, Summer, but I always get excited when I've ordered a Blue Apron meal and I know it's on my delivery day is Tuesday. Even though I saw the pictures and I knew what I ordered, it's still nothing like opening it up and putting everything together according to recipe, putting it in your fridge and figuring out what you're going to cook on which day.
My thing is that I set the menus up so far in advance that when they arrive, I'm kind of surprised by what's there. I'm like, oh, what did I order this week? Like it's like a present for my future self from my past self. This week I had maple gravy smothered pork chops with collard greens and roasted sweet potatoes. Now, I don't know about you guys, but there are certain proteins and that I get nervous about cooking because I am statistically bad at cooking pork. I just am. It always ends up dry. And maybe I think if I look back in the past, if I think back at the things I did differently with Blue Apron, is that I followed a recipe that gave me very specific instructions as to how to cook the pork without it drying out. And I had the most amazing little meal of pork chops. I enjoyed it. I was afraid it was going to be dry, but it was not. Directions are important. People follow them.
So Summer is, of course, referring to how easy it is. And even if you're not a cook or you're not a chef or you're not anything like that, they really do make it easy. There is prep involved, but they bring it to your doorstep. And all you have to do is a little chopping, a little mixing. But it typically doesn't take, what, more than a half an hour to do a meal?
It depends on how many items go into it.
How many ingredients?
I've had some that were like 4 ingredients and then spices. And then I've had some that were like 12 ingredients. And those ones take a little longer just because everything in those seems to call for a small dice. But this one had a lot of rough chopping and large dicing. So it was actually pretty quick to put together. So I've had some where it says it's going to be 45 minutes and it may have taken 48 minutes. They're pretty on target with with your expectations. And they send the most great comprehensive meal cards that give you the recipe and all the instructions with pictures. They're really easy to follow and they really set you up for success.
Being vegetarian, you might think it's a little more restrictive, or as a vegetarian, you still get a really wide range of ethnic cuisine. Like you might get Italian, you might get Californian, you might get Asian. I mean, it's all over the place. And I like that because me as a vegetarian, you're not eating tofu, you're not eating eggs every time. I find variety even as a vegetarian.
What I love about their new beta program is that what it used to be is there were basically 5 meals to choose from, maybe 6. It kind of guided you as to which ones you could have and you couldn't choose a specific combinations. However, with the new beta program, they allow you to pick any. They have 8 meals now to choose from, and you can pick any 3 out of the 8. And I thought going in that I was just going to pick, oh, well, I like meat. I'm going to pick all meat dishes. But I want you to know that last week I picked a vegetarian dish because it sounded good and it was good. So even for meat eaters, sometimes the vegetarian options just sound so good. You're like, maybe I don't need meat in that meal.
So check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals for free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/Outlander.
You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait.
That's blueapron.com/Outlander.
Blue Apron, a better way to cook. So, announcements this week. We actually have an announcement this week.
Yeah, and we're not going to talk about it very much or talk very long about it because we've already done a lot of that. And we want to help people if they want to join the conversation. We want to invite you to go to a specific place. Summer, what happened this week?
They released a teaser trailer
for season 3.
Emphasis on the word teaser.
I mean, I felt like it was a teaser, but I recognized so many things from it that it didn't feel like a tease to me.
Oh my gosh. Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, it was definitely a tease because we obviously want to see more. But if you haven't read the books, there's going to be stuff in there where you're like, okay. Like, they didn't show Willoughby. I'm a little surprised, but whatever.
Well, they got to save something for the season. But, I mean, honestly, anything, even if any trailer to me is a teaser. Because until it's the episodes, it's all teaser trailers.
Yeah, but this was so tiny that... Apparently, I've sung a lot today, so if I'm extra sing-songy, that's why. So, if you would like to discuss the teaser trailer, the first thing we've seen officially, besides a few stills, from season 3, which follows Voyager, please join our exclusive Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group.
And now, on to our read-along. Chapter 41, entitled We Set Sail.
It's late December, past Christmas, and they're still in Scotland. They at least now have the Artemis, but they're still in Scotland.
Are they still in Scotland or are they back in Scotland? Because weren't they just in whatever?
They were in Louvre and Paris, but the point is they haven't left to go find Ian. That's gotcha. What they were trying to stress. Young Ian had been gone for nearly a month. Jamie was of two minds. He was dreading the long Atlantic crossing, but also in a rush to get out and start the voyage. Ha ha, voyage! To find young Ian. Erica B. writes, I grew up near the ocean in Cape Cod. The description Diana writes here is very good and brings me back. Dead seaweed is not the most pleasant smell, and let's be thankful Yankee Candle didn't include that in the ocean breeze scented candle. Speaking of which, doesn't smell at all like an ocean breeze. Way too perfumey. So they had gone to Cape Wrath.
Wait. Could you actually imagine if an ocean breeze candle smelled like an ocean breeze? It would smell like salt and fish.
And seagulls. Yeah.
And
seaweed.
I mean, I don't think anybody really wants that in their house.
That's disgustable. Yeah, I agree. So they had gone to Cape Wrath, now that is a pretty awesome name, by the way, to retrieve Fergus and a small group of smugglers Jamie had sent him to fetch before leaving Havre. The smugglers, he included, were all, quote, men of the shore, who knew their way around boats and the ocean, if not ships. Quote, they would be hired on as part of the Artemis's crew, unquote. And I have included a link, a Wikipedia link, about the actual place called Cape Wrath in Scotland. Eileen P. writes, it's reassuring that Jamie has wisely chosen to bring his own men to join the crew of the Artemis. It's good to be surrounded by people who are loyal to you when you need to fight or go up against a shipload of pirates. That made me think of, quote, the impetuous pirate, unquote. Jamie was suffering during this waiting. Jamie walked the shore and would only come back to the ship into the cabin for meals. We learn that the name of the captain of the Artemis is Captain Rains. He is described as, quote, a small, plump, elderly man, unquote. Erica B. writes, it's mentioned in the next section that Rayburn is eating his pasty. Now, pasties are popular in my husband's family, which has Cornish heritage, and another spot where pasties are favored. Just thought I'd share that it's pronounced pasty, a short A sound, and is the key to getting it right. That's correct, because a pasty is something else.
Yes.
You don't eat them. Although I wonder
you could. I bet they make edible ones.
I was about to say, they may make edible ones.
You could make them out of fruit rolls, I'm sure.
Oh, Lord.
That's like true. A fruit roll up, just like cut it out and stick it on.
Okay. Claire is preparing some fresh ginger for use against nausea. Jamie sniffs it and sneezes. Claire admonishes him that it's not meant to be taken like snuff, yo. It's to be drunk in a tea. And that, she says, is the extent of her herbal knowledge to help his seasickness. Joe B. writes, Claire is excited about the coming adventure at this point, thinking that whilst it's risky, it won't be a hard task once in the West Indies to find Ian. Even if there is no paper trail, as there is for legitimate slave traders, Ian shouldn't be hard to find. And Jamie, whilst relieved there is a plan of action, is dreading the voyage. Knowing how sick he will be, Claire prepares ginger tea, a natural remedy for nausea and one that is still used today. Martina P. writes, I find it interesting and charming that Diana gives Jamie, aka the King of Men, seasickness. Such a weakness for a man of his caliber that simply cannot function when he is on the water. While Claire is trying to care for him, he is very cranky, and between the puking episodes, we do get some comic relief.
Well, I think that it's basically just his kryptonite. I mean, if you think of Superman being taken down by a rock, by the nearness of a rock, not even hit by it, not even like somebody like beaming him with this rock, just being in the presence of a green rock and he is powerless. So as far as issues to have, I mean, seasickness seems a lot more reasonable.
Claire is also one of his kryptonites. She strengthens him, but she also is a weak spot for him, as we found at the end of Outlander. Given hope by the captain and Jared, who both have the positive outlook that his seasickness may not last more than a few days, Jamie says, quote, "I can stand 3 days of it, I suppose," unquote. The next day, the six men arrive. They are Rayburn, Kennedy, Innes, who is missing his left arm, Meldrum, McLeod, and Gordon. Fergus wasn't to be seen. Fergus had some business to attend to and wouldn't be back for a day or two. But what business? Everyone was now there, save Fergus. The captain says they'll have to leave by mid-afternoon or they'll lose the tide. Weather is going to be surly soon, he says. Jamie was worried, of course, about Fergus. He'd been with him since they'd met in the Paris brothel, and he was like an older brother to young Ian. They were all getting worried because, as Claire put it, quote, "I could not imagine any business so urgent that it would have kept him from Jamie's side," unquote. Erica B. writes, "Fergus was late. Oh, dear. He's pregnant, LOL. The first thing that crossed my mind." Then they actually had to go. At the very last minute, Fergus shows up on a horse, and they take off. Claire is thrilled to feel the ship come alive beneath her feet. Jamie, on the other hand, says, oh, God, feeling the same thing. He grasped the rail, closed his eyes, and swallowed, unquote. So Mr. Willoughby has said he has a cure for seasickness, Claire tells him. Jamie's not too confident of this. But then Fergus appears with a girl. Quote, "Fergus, reaching up to help down a girl perched awkwardly above him on the railing, her long blonde hair whipping in the wind. Leary's daughter, Marsali McKimmy," unquote.
Isn't it Marsley?
We'll get there.
Supposed to rhyme with parsley?
OMG. Oopsie. Fergus says that they're married. They haven't bedded each other, though, yet. Well, Fergus says no. Marsali says, yes, he has. Jamie orders the ship back to the shore immediately to drop off the girl, but it's too late. So he asks them more questions. He finds out that they're actually handfast before witnesses, and there's a contract with signatures that she's got. Quote, "By the laws of Scotland, two people could in fact be legally married by clasping hands before witnesses, handfasting, and declaring themselves to be man and wife," unquote. Now, Jamie still has plans to send Marsali back to shore when they stop at Lewes. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Lewes. Marsali says she won't, and that she did leave word. She sent a letter from Inverness saying she'd married Fergus, and they were off to sail with Jamie. To be fair, Fergus had formally asked for Marsali's hand in marriage, but it wasn't accepted by Leary. That's an understatement. Eileen P. writes, "Fergus finally arrives as the Artemis is casting off. Surprise! He's handfast to Marsali, Leary's daughter. It's too late to turn back. Good thing Jamie and all involved are leaving the country far from Leary's reach and wrath." Eric B. writes, "For what it's worth, later in the book, there is a spot where we learn how to say Marsali, and it's not like parsley. I just read it the other night. I made a mental note, but I didn't mark it anywhere where it was. But know that we are saying it correctly." So, Summer, what are we going to do? The books came first. Davina came second. Davina has always says, and I think we'll continue to say, Marsali. Now, I am not judging anyone or anything. From what we understand, the series is going to call her Marsley. So, do we call it or just do what we're going to do? And if one slips out, one slips out.
I mean, I thought it was Marsley. In like 5 months? 5 months now, everyone's going to be pronouncing it Marsley. So we might as well jump on the Marsley bandwagon and just start calling her Marsley.
I'm okay with going forward like that. But having read the books for less than 20 years, but you for 20 years, it's going to be very difficult for me to say Marsali consistently. So I'm saying it's going to pop in and out. But we can go forward with the intent of saying the one you said.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll just keep saying Marsley.
That's fine. Let's do that. You say Marsley, Arsay? Don't Arsay.
Arsley?
Arsley. Oh, no. You say Marsley and I'll say Marsali. That would be awesome. Lisa T. writes, Marsali must have taken notes from young Ian on how to leave word for your mom, for your ma'am, before running off. I can't help laughing when Jamie is horror-stricken, thinking that Leary will think he knew about this. Marsali shows exactly the stuff she is made of when she stands up to Jamie and declares that she wants Fergus, regardless of the fact that he is a bastard and a criminal. We find out, this is where it starts, forget Parsley, this is where it starts getting a little uncomfortable. We find out Marsali is 15 and Fergus is 30. Holy Moses. That's a whole other not podcast. Okay. It's not. There are podcasts about this subject, I'm pretty sure, and we're not one of them. Huh. Marsali.
I mean, I know it was another time, but I have to keep that fact out of my brain. Because when I think that fact, it bothers me. What the hell is that?
I'm just playing with the effects. Oh, it's gone. Marsali doesn't understand that Jamie can take Claire and that she can't go with Fergus. Quote, you leave my mother for this English whore and make her a laughingstock for the whole countryside, and it's not my concern, is it? And you have the hellish nerve to tell me what I shall do? Unquote. Jamie says it's, meaning Claire, it's his private affair and not her concern. She snaps back that hers aren't any concern of his. You can imagine the look on Fergus's face, like, whoa there, Nelly, this is not the right direction. And he warns her. She says she'll speak to Milor in any way she wants. And Fergus sets her straight. No, you will not. But then he was softer to her. He tells her that he owes Jamie his life 1,000 times over. He is her stepfather as well, and he has supported and sheltered her family. She at least owes him respect. She apologizes to Jamie, and Jamie accepts it, but says that she still must go back to her mother. Marsali is determined not to. She says that if they send her home, she will say that she's been ruined by Fergus. Quote, so you see, I shall either be married or ruined. Unquote. Well, she's got you there, Jamie. Jamie says, quote, all right, you're married, but you'll do it right before a priest. We'll find one in the Indies when we land. And until you've been blessed, Fergus doesn't touch you. I, unquote. Fergus is pleased as punch. Quote, yes, milor. Marsali replies, yes, daddy.
Daddy.
I was about to say, yeah. That's the line that Summer likes that makes me feel gross. This is just weird. Two of Jamie's pseudo-children marrying? Cue the incest train.
I mean, none of them are actually his.
I know that. It's still funky town.
They weren't raised together. It wasn't that funky. It's grosser that he's 30 and she's 15.
Oh, I already said that part.
I know. I'm just saying, of all of the reasons to be against this match, the fact that they're quasi-siblings, which they're not, is not a big deal compared to the fact that he was around when she was born. Like, he was when he was 15, she was born. Blah.
Erica B. writes, oh, snap. Fergus, the voice of reason to a teenage girl that is definitely acting her age in this scene, I must say. Martina P. writes, while the Artemis anchors at a small Scottish port, Fergus finally arrives and boards the ship with his surprise guest, Marsali. At first, I was not a big Marsali fan. She bothered me with her unfavorable attitude toward Claire, mainly, and honestly, because she is the daughter of our beloved Leary. That fact alone bothered me quite a bit. However, throughout the chapter, she gains my respect because at her young age, she has a fire in her belly. And no, it's not a pregnancy yet.
I was going to say, I'll tell you what she doesn't have in her belly.
That's just adorable. She stands her ground and defies everyone but Fergus. Lisa T. writes, Fergus has been like a son to Jamie also. It reminds me a little of Jamie and Myrta. Speaking of fathers and children, enter Marsali, another reminder of Leary. They wouldn't be going on this voyage if it weren't for Leary and her financial settlement. Joe B. writes, Marsali, her mother's daughter, knows what or who she wants and gets him. Her arguments are unanswerable by her stepfather, and I do get a bit of pleasure at the outgunning of Jamie sometimes. He is so used to being in control, even of the bad things that happen to him. It's nice to be reminded that the king of men has feet of clay. How much more so is this the case when it's a 15-year-old girl? Marsali reminds me, and probably Jamie, of Geneva Dunsany. However, where Jamie can admire courage in Geneva due to their social distance, he cannot allow this to cloud his interaction with his stepdaughter. It is also good to see an impassioned defense of Leary. We may not like her, but she has been subjected to a pretty awful situation, granted some of it her own making. She has also been the object to the harsh gossip of her community. No matter what we think of Leary, her daughter loved her and is distressed and angered to see the man she considers a father abandon her mother for another woman. Marsali calling him daddy here is a slap to his seeming, at least to her, self-righteousness and hypocrisy. Lisa T. writes, Marsali forces Jamie into letting her stay. She reminds me a bit of Geneva in this scene when Geneva blackmails Jamie into sleeping with her. Also, Fergus mentioning that Jamie has been more than a father to him reminds us that Jamie does actually have a son, Willie. Jamie thinks he has the upper hand when he insists that Fergus will not touch Marsali until they are properly wedded. But just like before, through no fault of her own, little Miss Daddy will find a way to come between Jamie and Claire. Jamie is getting sicker by the minute. He's thinking he may never see Scotland again, but Claire says she knows he'll come back. He looks at her, and then it hits him. Quote, you've seen my grave, haven't you? She nods. Quote, it's all right, he says. Don't tell me when, though, if you didn't mind. I can't, she says. There weren't any dates on it, just your name and mine, unquote.
Convenient.
Exactly. Yours? His eyes popped open. She remembers the stone she'd seen, a marriage stone. It had had all of his names on it, and it said, beloved husband of Claire. At the time, she didn't understand how that could be, and now she does. Now, back up a second. Isn't this that...
They don't know that yet. You shush your mouth.
I can't, okay.
No, I didn't know. Can't say that.
When does that come out? In...
You need to bicycle horn that whole section. Leave it in.
No, it's going to... What are you talking about?
It'll be funny if you put the bicycle horn over you saying, isn't that the bracket or that bracket, bracket?
Oh, that's
and then
funny.
I'll say,
okay.
You can't say that. You have to take that whole thing out. They don't know that yet.
He deduces in his own way. Quote, it also means we'll find young Ian safe. For I tell you, Sassenach, I will not set foot in Scotland again without him. Unquote. Eileen P. writes, it's so reassuring when Claire tells Jamie about his gravestone. We know... Now, hold on a second. If I read that in any other context, I don't think I'd be reassured if someone saw my gravestone. But I understand what she means. We know that no matter what, Jamie will return to Scotland and be married to Claire. It's getting dark, and Jamie finally allows himself to be led below. They realize what keeping Fergus away from Marsali means. Jamie and Fergus would have to take one bed, Claire and Marsali the other. Lisa T. writes, once again, Claire and Jamie are separated, at least sexually.
By a little girl.
Fergus offers to tend to Jamie and let Claire get some rest. She tells Jamie that perhaps he'll feel better in the morning. Quote, Jamie opened one eye for a moment and then groaned and shivered, closed it again. Or perhaps I'll be dead, he suggested. LOL. Claire goes to leave and then stumbles over Mr. Willoughby, who was sleeping right next to the door. She gets to her room. Not much happens right there, but he gets up, turns around, and gets comfortable again. So we're just keeping, number one, a reminder that he's there. Number two, a reminder or telling us that he's literally right outside the door at this point. Claire gets to her room and Marsali is asleep. Claire falls peacefully asleep to the sound of the sea and Jamie's retching. Claire tells us that basic hygiene is suffering on the ship. She got rid of a rat on day two, and there were also cockroaches, we find out. But overall, it was a horrific hygiene disaster waiting to happen. Quote, all the holy stoning in the world could not disguise the fact that 24 human beings occupied this limited space and only one of us bathed. Unquote. That would be pretty nasty. The one exception to the dim and grubby conditions is the galley. It was so shiny and new. Come aboard. We're expecting you, the lifeboat. Okay, that was an interesting note. She approaches the galley. The cook tells her immediately, out. She greets him, but again, he says, out. She tells him who she is and says that she requires 6 gallons of boiling water for the cleaning of the head. He replies, I am Aloysius O'Shaughnessy Murphy, ship's cook, and I require you to take your feet off my fresh washed deck. I do not allow women in my galley, unquote. She steps back out onto outside of the galley, and she says that he may send water by the mess boy then. And he says in return, he may or he may not. So Claire, cleverly, starts to list off a number of culinary herbs. And she even throws in some saffron. And he says, once he understands what she's getting at, wipe your shoes and come in. So she basically shares with him. Erica B. writes, I love that Claire uses her wit and decides to bribe Murphy for hot water with spices. Smart. A new friend, and the cook is a good one to have, I think. Absolutely. Lisa T. writes, it sounds just lovely. Claire realizes that she needs to get things sanitized. She meets the ship's cook who refuses to let her into the kitchen and refuses to help her. True to herself, Claire proves a worthy adversary with a nose like a truffle pig. This scene reminds me of her first proving her healing skills in the cottage at the beginning of Outlander. In Dragonfly and Amber, she proves herself to both Maître Raymond and Mother Hildegard. This is Claire using her gifts and her strength, as she does so often, to do the best she can for those in her care. So they wash the head, and it's time for lunch. She and Marsali had the largest cabin, and that equals about 6 square feet each. And the beds inside the cabin were box beds. Now, Marsali was small enough to fit. Claire, not so much, not without some adjustment. And poor Jamie, not even to speak of Jamie. Jamie is still sick. He says he'll be dead by the morning. She replies, afraid not. Nobody dies of seasickness. He says he doesn't mean of seasickness. He says he has to warn her, but he's so sick he doesn't have the energy to tell her. And she's like, what are you on about? And he says, ask Fergus. Tell him that I say he must tell you. And tell him that Innes is all right. Apparently Innes isn't the one who means to kill Jamie. Say what? Kill who? What? This is all like sideways to the reader. We're like, wait, huh? So Jamie doesn't know who does mean to kill him. As she leaves, though, she sees Willoughby. Willoughby says, quote, not to worry, honorable first wife, I watch, unquote. So now we have another reason, whether Willoughby knew or not, or he was just telling her after overhearing this conversation, another reason for Willoughby to be hanging out by the door. Fergus says that they're not sure anyone actually intends to kill Jamie. But the day before she met Fergus in the brothel after her return, Fergus had been at Burntisland docks with Jamie and the 6 men taking advantage of the darkness to retrieve several casks of smuggled, unbonded Madeira. The same 6 men. They brought it to the warehouse, and 2 of the men had asked for their shares at once, needing the money to pay debts. Jamie agreed to pay them, and he went to where the gold was kept, and all of a sudden, a 2-ton cask rolls on the stack and smashes on the floor, and then its other fellow casks do the same. Jamie was crossing right in front of it, but there were other things as well, not just this near miss. So Jamie was almost taken out by casks. A week before the cask incident, Jamie was working in a shed that was full of straw, and the straw caught fire while he was in it. Again, he had been able to escape. And then, there, of course, there was the event that Claire was present at, the foiled event at Arbroath. They think they may have a traitor among the smugglers. But what worries Jamie most is the man who Mr. Willoughby saw shot at the brothel. So remember that booklet he had? It was a small New Testament, and it was one that Jamie had printed. So this was a dangerous piece of information. So it seems that to connect the brandy to the brothel is not a big deal, but to connect the person of Jamie Roy with Mr. Malcolm of Carfax Close, that wouldn't be good. There was real danger that if these two identities were connected, it could affect his freedom, his family's freedom, his friends, and of course, Lallybroch, the estate, and put everything in jeopardy. Claire is not happy to hear there is drama, but she is happy that she didn't have anything to do with this current drama. She's like, that stuff was before I got here.
Well, I happen to think that all of those things could very well be sabotage things, except for the straw. I think he could have lit that on fire himself because he's so hot.
Oh, Lord have mercy. She goes there. Okay.
So hot.
So the question is there a traitor among them? And if so, does that person want to kill Jamie? So the six men were purposely chosen by Jamie. They were all present when the casks fell and present when the shed caught fire and, of course, on the road to Arbroath when they were ambushed.
Can you imagine being the guy who's the bad guy and continually being chosen for all these things? He's thinking, I'm so in. I'm going to get it this time. He has no idea. It's me.
Exactly. Because I'm with the same other five dudes. He'll have no clue. And all six had also been to the brothel at some point or another. So they all had similar backgrounds or similar, at least working with Jamie. They had all been present at these really opportune or inopportune times when this danger stuff had gone down. The men do not know about the print shop, however. But now all of the men do know Jamie's real name, as the captain is calling him Fraser. Eileen P. writes, "It's sad that Jamie is on the run again, this time with a possible traitor among his men. It's bad enough that he needs to rescue young Ian. Does he need to be worried about being killed by one of his own men or being captured by the English and hanged? Jamie Fraser leads a complicated life." Lisa T. writes, "This is very wise of Jamie to bring on the six men, especially since we know he will never make a good sailor. Jamie may have his secrets, but Claire knows him better than anyone. Fergus explains that someone has connected A. Malcolm and Jamie Roy, which is very bad for Jamie. This reminds me of Claire asking Jamie who she was, Mrs. Malcolm, etc., and he tells her that whoever he is, she is his wife." Martina P. writes, "Fergus informs Claire about the possible traitor among the smugglers, which will pose a threat to Jamie. I don't even pretend to understand the whole plot. Also, the incident with the excise men that was the man that was killed by Mr. Willoughby, it is all very confusing to me. I cannot keep up who knows which of Jamie's identities. Maybe someone else can figure it out and explain it to me. Also, Claire describes Fergus as a grown and dangerous man. Oddly, I don't see Fergus as a 30-year-old man at all, especially when his wife is only half his age. In my mind, he is a man on a day over 20.
Too bad he's 30 and his hand-fasted wife is 15.
Wait, are they hand-fasted or hook-fasted?
I imagine he used the hand with the hand.
The actual fingers.
Yeah. I don't think it could count if it was hook to hand.
You could use your foot. But
what if they're wrist fasted?
Oh, Lord. Marsali had heard all of this. She was there in the room with Fergus. Claire tells them to go below. She's going to the galley to see if the cook has anything for seasick. They're giving it the good college try, yo. Time goes on. Jamie is still really sick. The cook cannot help him. Claire spends her days going about the ship, tending to medical emergencies as she can, and pounding herbs into medicines in the corner of the galley. Here, in the middle of the chapter, we learn that the cook has a wooden leg. It's funny that Diana did not mention that earlier. It's like all of a sudden, oh, by the way, the cook's got a wooden leg.
Didn't she mention it the first time she described him?
Maybe. But then why would she say it was part of the initials? Why would she? I didn't read it. I did not have it in my notes because when I read it, I was shocked in the middle of the chapter. That's why I wrote, in the middle of the chapter, we find out. Now, it's possible it was in the chapter and I missed it, but I think I would have seen that he had a wooden leg, but maybe not. And also, if we already knew this, why is she bringing our eyes to it again? Because she calls him some kind of pirate something. So that's why it was so shocking to me. So Claire takes the latest concoctions and a gherkin into Jamie's cabin. Still nothing.
Never forget your gherkin.
Exactly. Still nothing works. He's still crazy seasick. She tries one of her tricks she used to use with surgical patients. She leads him in a guided meditation of Lallybroch and the surroundings. He tells her, Sassenach, go away. And as she leaves his room, she has a conversation with Willoughby. And she has it right outside the door in full earshot of Jamie on purpose. So Willoughby asks or starts talking about like animals and what year, certain year of this, year of that. And she tells him that Jamie was born in 1721. Willoughby guesses that Jamie might be year of the rat or year of the dragon. He also offers his Chinese medicine. He's got Chinese medicine. Claire continues their line of discussion of the results of continued retching. And he catches on really fast. She says, ultimately, the testicles can become tangled around each other inside the scrotum and cuts off the circulation there. In that case, the only treatment is to amputate before gangrene sets in. Jamie hears this and says, damn the pair of you. Come in then.
Guys are so easy.
Oh my goodness, just mention the cha-chas and they're in your hand, the palm of your hand.
The cha-chas are in your hand?
Oh, no. The
just men mention are the their palm cha-chas and it's in your hand.
Boom.
You're making it worse.
I know. After Mr. Willoughby's ministrations, Jamie is well enough to walk around the ship. But what to Fergus's wandering eyes should appear but Jamie Fazer dressed up like Pinhead from Hellraiser? Here's how it went down. Fergus sees him and gasps. Jamie says, not one word, if you please. Marsali full-on screams, Dad, what's happened to you? Jamie's face is filled with slender gold needles. He tells her, quote, it's all right. It's only some rubbish of the Chinese's to cure the puking. He says, quote, I feel like a bloody ill-wish doll that someone's been poking full of pins. But then I haven't vomited in the last quarter hour, so I suppose it must work, unquote. And as Jamie walks by, Mr. Willoughby, who'd been calculating something on his fingers, says, not rat, not dragon, too. Jamie born year of ox, unquote. And Claire thinks, how appropriate. Eileen P. writes, yay, Mr. Willoughby to the rescue. Claire brought syringes of penicillin, which saved Jamie from infection and possible death. Mr. Willoughby brought acupuncture needles, which stopped Jamie's debilitating seasickness and potentially prevented an amputation of a very important body part. Three cheers for alternative medicine. What is it about characters bringing needles when they're traveling far from home? Forethought. Erica B. writes, I do hope they keep this delightful scene in the series where Claire and Mr. Willoughby are chatting in earshot of Jamie about why dry heaving is so bad. It will certainly lighten the mood a bit. I can't wait to see Sam covered in acupuncture needles, a sight to be seen. This makes me wonder, though, how long does he have to wear these? In my first read-through of the book last year, I had it in my head that it was kind of a 24/7 type deal. But as we read more, it doesn't seem to be the case. I'm curious what you guys think. How often do you think he has to have this done? One time per trip, once a day? I really have no clue.
It sounds like constantly.
That's what my guess would be. Because we know how he's like without him.
My perception, every time I read the book, is that they have to be in like all the time. Like, I imagine they probably, or at the very least every morning.
Oh yeah. Like a new,
like take them off when he goes to bed and then put them back in first thing in the morning. That's what I imagine.
Yeah. That's actually a good question for Diana too. And we'll find out whether it's what Diana intended or just what they did for the adaptation. We'll find that out in probably not September, but maybe October. Jamie is an ox. We find out. Erica B. writes, I'm a monkey. I made a poll in the FB group because I'm curious to see what our demographics are, LOL. If I'm not mistaken, there was hella dragons. Hella dragons. I was like, what? I didn't know that in our group, our group is growing, but we're still, you know, we're not millions. We're just over 1,000. But I mean, those, and we didn't have 1,000 replies to the poll, but those who did answer, I was shocked. Did you answer the poll too?
Yeah.
What are you again?
I'm a horse.
I thought you were about to say I'm a whore.
I mean, I am that as well, but my Chinese astrology is a horse.
What is Lene? Is she my same year as you.
So you guys are dragons, right?
Okay, so that would make sense. Lene is a dragon. So we're both dragons.
But can I just say that he's also a Taurus?
That's true.
So he's a Taurus, which is a bull and an ox. They're kind of, it's all hand in hand.
That is funny because, yeah, I'm a dragon and I'm a Leo. Obviously, one's feline and one's, I don't know, dragony. But they're both, I don't know that you would call a dragon a sun sign because it's not a sun, it's a whole year. But a Leo is definitely a sun sign. And I get, even though there's there's fire, I guess. It's a fire sign. That's what they say. It's a fire sign. Oh, sun signs are as opposed to moon signs. Excuse me. It's a fire sign. So I guess you could say they both have fire. I don't know that. And then Lene, I think, is an Aries, right?
Yes.
So she's an air sign, right?
Yes.
So fire and air. So she's got some like one feeding into the other there. So she's a hot tamale. We love you, Lene. That is pretty freaking awesome. Okay, back to the people. Joe B. writes, we meet the chorus of characters who will sail with us as Claire is forced into Lady Jane mode as with Murphy the cook, she meets a match. She proves herself worthy and her work to get the ship as clean as possible begins. In Murphy and Mr. Willoughby, Claire finds allies in her mission to cure Jamie. Murphy is especially taking this challenge to heart in MasterChef 1767.
I would just like to say that Claire's taste in cohorts and sidekicks has improved greatly since the 1740s.
Who was it then?
Galus.
Galus? I was about to say, that's the only one I can think of, Galus. When diet doesn't work, Claire and Mr. Willoughby fall back on the tried and true old chestnut, if you will, of threatening his manhood. In a broad sense, Jamie submits to acupuncture, which works. I had thought that Claire might have recognized this technique given her interest in alternative treatments, but according to a history of acupuncture website, who knew, it wasn't widely used until the early 1970s. That makes sense. That makes sense. So she wouldn't have likely been too exposed to it in 50s or 60s Boston. So I can see that. Lisa T. writes, Jamie emerges feeling a bit better, but looking quite a sight. I seriously hope we get to see this scene. It's so funny. Oh, Lucifer, son of morning? Not quite, but Jamie does look like he has devil's horns in the morning light. After the shock and impotence of young Ian's kidnapping, Red Jamie is back. Okay, I have a cute... I think it's cute. I have a... It's just weird. I have a little tiny short tail. I think... Well, not tail. I don't have a tail.
Lies. She does. She totally has a tail.
I have a short story.
It's super fluffy. And that's a lie, too.
My stories are
never have a short story.
I know. I may have a short tail. I'm just kidding. So when we were in Hawaii recently, I'm pretty sure it happened there. I must have been distracted reading or looking at something, probably my phone. And Summer and my sister's daughter, Summer and her daughter were in the same room. And our mom was all, we're all in the same room. I don't know where my dad was. You were asking, our mom was asking about the stars in the sky and what was visible at different times in the morning or the day. Someone asked, what do you call that star, the star in the morning? And I straight up hear this and I say, oh, Lucifer. Do you remember that?
It was just last week.
I know that. So you remember? Our mom looked at me like I had just like, my head had twisted around backwards and I had horns or something. She's like, what? What are you saying?
No, like, Dad was the one who was like, what? Because the answer is Venus, because he was asking what this first star or the last star or whatever star that you see in the morning, and it's known as the morning star, which is Venus, which is actually a planet. Anyway, that was the correct answer. I got the question right, and Ginger's in the back seat screaming, oh, Lucifer! Yes.
All I heard was, what do you call the morning star? And I'm like, Lucifer. And I'm like,
no, you
I
don't. Think,
yes, you do. It's in the Bible. I'm not saying the Bible is everybody's gospel. I'm just saying it was a completely different conversation than I heard. You were talking literally, what's the thing in the sky that we see? And I thought it was more figurative, who's called the morning star? So I said Lucifer, and you said Venus.
Well, because I was right.
Because you were literal. The conversation was literal, and I didn't know it was literal. But I went with my first, I just thought it was funny. So when Lisa T mentioned Lucifer, I was like, gotta tell it, because it just made me laugh. I was like, how random is this? Martina P. writes, I love the cooperation between Claire and Mr. Willoughby talking about entangled testicles to trick Jamie into giving acupuncture a go. It was hilarious how he suddenly paid attention and, may I just say, acts like a typical man, giving in only when the precious body part is involved or in jeopardy. And she continues, I actually looked up the Chinese zodiac sign for the year 1721, and it is indeed the ox. Quote,
is anyone surprised? Come on, it's Diana. Of course it's correct.
Quote, oxes are, I thought it was oxes, not the animal oxen, but people who are in the year of the ox. So oxes are known for diligence, dependability, strength, and determination. Having an honest nature, oxes have strong patriotism for their country, have ideals and ambitions for life, and attach importance to family and work. Traditional characteristics of conservatives, unquote. That would be interesting to read about the dragon. Well, we could do it right now. What are you? You're a horse?
I'm a horse.
You're a whore. You're the whore.
Again. That's every year. Still.
Lord have mercy. Okay, I'm trying to go to the horse. It's just slow. So where's horse? Personality of the horse. They always impress upon people with dynamic, zealous, and generous image. It doesn't sound like it's really well-written English, but although endowed with many shining points, they have to face the weaknesses in their characteristics. Okay, this is definitely a bad translation, probably from the Chinese. Okay, strengths. Most have nice personalities, such as warm-hearted, upright, and easygoing. You're upright, Summer. Hence, they usually have a lot of friends flocking to them. Independence and endurance make them more powerful, and they do not easily give up when in difficulties. Positive attitude leads to a brighter direction. I gotta find another one because I can't read this. It's too hard. Okay, horse zodiac. There we go. People born in the year of the horse are extremely animated, active, and energetic. Horses love to be in a crowd, and they can usually be seen on such occasions as concerts, theater performances, meetings, sporting events, and parties. With a deft sense of humor, horses are masters of repartee. They love to take center stage and delight audiences everywhere. Sometimes the horse is a little self-centered, but it doesn't mean that he or she cannot be interested in others' problems. Horses are really more cunning than intelligent, and that is probably why most horse people lack real confidence. Huh.
Eh.
You were born in 78? You're an earth horse. Earth horse. As opposed
to a
wood.
I'm a Virgo too, which is
earth. You're right. That's funny. Optimistic, kind-hearted, righteous, but irritable, with a strong sense of responsibility and always ready to help others. Now let's go look up Year of Dragon. I'm a dragoon. You're a hood.
You're the hood. Issues.
I'm having fun. Wait, is this the bad? Yeah, this is the bad translation site. Let me go back to the good. Better. Not the good, but the better. La-da-da-da-da. Okay. What type of dragon are you? I am a 76. I'm a fire dragon. Hello. Smart, unreliable, and easygoing. I am very reliable, but I am totally not easygoing. So do you agree?
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. So lucky numbers, 167. Lucky colors, gold, silver, grayish, white. Lucky flowers, bleeding heart, glory bower, dragon flowers. Lucky directions are east, north, and south. That's a lot. I'm not really satisfied with that. I will never be satisfied. Let's go back to your Chinese. Okay, maybe this is it. As the symbol of the Chinese nation, dragon represents authority and good fortune. It has the fifth position among the Chinese zodiac animals. People born in the year of the dragon are powerful, kind-hearted, successful, innovative, brave, healthy, courageous, and enterprising. However, we got to own the good with the bad. They tend to be conceited, scrutinizing, tactless, I have to admit to that, quick-tempered, and overconfident. That's funny. Among the 12 Chinese zodiac signs, dragon is the only fictitious and deified animal that doesn't exist in the world. It is one of the four most revered animals of ancient China. Images now we see are just from people's imaginations. Because of this, the people born in the year of the dragon are usually dreamers and fond of imagining. Yeah, that's not true. I'm so not a dreamer. I don't imagine anything. This gives others an unreal sense about them. To mention about their work, they can work hard at the beginning, but usually give up once they encounter difficulties. The permanent jobs with fixed salaries are not for them. Those need more imagination, like interior designers, architects, artists, and cultural workers are suitable for them. Huh. The dragon women usually are typical modern occupation female. Okay, again, bad translation, but it's better than the first one. Paying much attention to their work while neglecting marriage. In general, people under the dragon sign are mostly marry at a mature age as concentrating too much on their career. Well, I don't know that I concentrate on a career, but I definitely don't concentrate on a marriage. So that's funny. That's really funny. That's interesting. I won't go on. You guys can go look up Chinese Zodiac and maybe we'll put another poll up or find Erica's. I think it was Erica. Whoever did it, go find that poll too. But wow, that was interesting. Oh, we got to look up Claire. Wanna look her up? Chinese Zodiac, 1918, right? Oh, she's a horse. She's a hood.
That's my girl.
She's a horse. A hood and a lush. Very good. Okay. I think we're good.
And that was chapter 41. Join us next time when we discuss chapters 42, 43, and 44. They're short, so we're putting them all together. And 42 is The Man in the Moon. 43 is entitled Phantom Limbs. And 44, Forces of Nature.
Don't forget to pop on over to our Facebook group at outlanderpod.com/group and join in the discussion of the teaser trailer and this episode. We'd love to hear what you think. What is your Chinese zodiac sign, and do you agree or do you disagree? Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at OutlanderPod.